Always Record, episode 28. We have Vinny Eastwood joining us in the second hour.
...124 years, to the year 3136 AD. And then there's evidence that they had things extended further into the future because there's a tomb, there's an inscription showing October 13th, 4772 AD. So it's just this, like, you know, there's these indicators that obviously it's not the end of time, it's just the end of that calendar, which should be common knowledge, but unfortunately it's not. And then I have my friend who visits Guatemala and Peru and, you know, very immersed in their culture. He's just like, we don't grok the Mayan cycles of time because, first of all, they're represented. They have to do with concentric circles and spirals and multiverses and levels of being and enlightenment, and that it's not linear. And to project something linear onto it is kind of missing the point. It's like we're limiting the information by doing that.
Yeah, I think it's basically like they're, from what I've studied, all the different calendars are essentially a bunch of different cycles. So these are sort of like gears in a clock. It would be like pulling out a single gear in a clock and saying this is the time, when a clock, an actual clock, anything that you can experience, is made up of many of them.
Right. Yep. It's a thing. I don't know, it's strange. I like look at the Mayan, the, I guess you'd say, the 13th Bakhtun period calendar.
Right.
And it's amazing that they can extrapolate what they do from what you're looking at. Cuz I mean, I see the glyphs surrounding. I've read some of Jose Arguelles' ideas around that, and I take many of them with a grain of salt, but I'm just like, wow, we got this much information from this thing. It's incredible.
Yeah, the Mayan glyphs certainly look more simplified or minimalist. So it's there's that extra leap there. But there, I've seen, you know, other variations on those glyphs. So it's sort of like, how should I say, if you understand what that day means, you know, that's a glyph for a certain day.
Mm-hmm.
And that these are, it's almost like saying, you know, someone's a Gemini born with this sign, you know, it's like, is you're giving a sort of specific period, or a specific energetic is probably a better way to put it. It's interesting because the correlation here to like the I Ching, you know, of course this is purely coming out of McKenna, finding the correlation between his time wave and this theoretical calendar end date. Which it would actually be very interesting to see what would have happened if he had never discovered that there was this thought Mayan correlation.
Mm-hmm.
Because originally he just says it ends in 2012. Then he had like kind of shuffled that date around. Then he came across this Mayan quote unquote end date from another researcher and decided, okay, well, that's close enough. That's probably what I was tapping into. Which I could understand why you would do that. Like, you have to realize, right, what we do when we're trying to find, like, we're cluing into something, and then when you find some sort of evidence of, like, oh, shit, was that? That's almost exactly what I was thinking. Okay, maybe someone else figured this out first. I can totally see why he would say, well, if that's really close and I wasn't exactly sure what I was tapping into here. But I just think it's interesting, this idea of a sort of glyph representing an energetic. We take that to the I Ching with the hexagrams, and it also, now obviously not being used as a calendar, but being used as a calendar of sorts, a calendar of energetics. This the Mayan circular version here you show here, I mean, you've seen the hexagrams also arranged in a circular format. Now, this is, you know, it's not like anything like, ooh, you put them in a circle. You can do that with tarot cards and things like that. You can basically put anything in a circle. But that was something that just a few years ago sort of struck me as an interesting further correlation, that if you've seen circular arrangements of the I Ching, if a part of me wondered at what point you can make these additional correspondences. I actually have a question for you, is along the same lines, is there's the idea that Crowley is said to have matched the hexagrams to the tarot, right?
To a degree, yes.
Well, okay, yeah, thank you. So, because I've looked into that, because, I mean, I've studied the I Ching, not, you know, not like scholarly, you know, for 5 year, whatever, but I mean, I think I've done more than a good number of people. My question is that, so obviously there's 64 hexagrams, 78 cards. So you can't have a direct correlation. And the only thing that I'm able to see, Crowley has a version of the I Ching that he translates, or sort of modifies slightly. And then you have the 777, the Book of Correspondences, where he has an appendix with the hexagrams.
Right. And then in the Book of Thoth, he repeatedly will draw parallels when looking at the cards, just basically like open source sync. Like he just like he's like, well, this relates to this, and then he draws ideas out of that. He extrapolates information by looking at parallels of where things would land, and so it's helpful like using all of those together to a degree. But he at the same time, I feel like he kind of felt like he was getting a ball rolling in that direction. Like it wasn't by any means like complete, and I don't think he was pretending that it was. He was like, when you read it, I don't remember. Oh, are you still there?
Oh yeah, I'm here. I was just muting so you could
talk. Oh, okay. Well, maybe it was in Magic Without Tears. Don't quote me on that, but I know I read in one of his later books where he's talking about 777, or maybe it was actually in a later preface to it that he had done, like an introduction page to a later copy of 777, where he basically expresses how limited he feels that that is and how much further he's gone since then, and then how much further one could go in terms of the correspondences. So, like, to use that book to consider it like, you know, like a synchronistic Bible is kind of ridiculous, considering that how much more work was to be done in that area. So, like, you can't, you know, it's by no means a finished thing. But what he, and then there's other places where he expresses that his connection with the I Ching and tarot he considers one of the most significant things he's ever done by far, as incomplete as it is, just because if you were to actually do that and find that, you would have to really stop and think what, like, okay, so I mean, I doubt that, or I don't know. I would say that I doubt that there's actually a direct link in terms of people communicating to the degree that we might expect in terms of, like, you know, this information being the same school, which is possible, but it seems more like this is the way things are, and so people are going to come to it. If there's any truth in it, mm-hmm. people are going to come to it.
Yeah.
And so that would be a personally, that feels like a more logical explanation. Though I could consider that there's a esoteric school that these people are in a direct line, but that's, you know, there's a pretty big gulf.
I don't think that's true, both historically and just from our experience. I mean, it seems like, you know, you've been studying the esoteric side longer than a lot of the people in the Sync community. But, you know, for all the people who were just tapping into something and sort of feeling around in the dark, either through psychedelic experiences, mapping out synchronicities. Even the guys who were just, you could argue the guys who are just looking at movies or something, well, they're picking up on the esoteric data that was inserted into it. That's possible. But what I really feel at my core is true, though, is that if all these different people looking at different things, some people are studying politics, some people are studying movies, some people are studying music, some people are just, you know, exploring the synchronicities in their own life. Obviously, that's always a correlation in all these things. But and then some people start to get into esoteric schools. And what I know I discovered is, hey, this is what these are kind of words for what I was thinking. This is how I kind of saw it working. And then I see other people saying, hey, we think it works like this. So what I feel is exactly when you said, if there's a truth, multiple people are going to come to it. It seems that I think our modern sync movement has sort of shown that to be the case.
Yeah. The whole idea of the archetypes in that way seems totally reasonable to me. You'll like this, Alan. My girlfriend's family in Seattle were sitting around the table, and they're very, very conservative. You know, just about all of them. And I brought up started talking about Groundhog Day. Someone said Phil, and they were talking Groundhog Day, and so I was like, I actually have a friend who goes through that film and looks at it completely in terms of tarot, section by section, and looks at the 22 major arcana of a tarot deck. These people have their relationship, if any, to tarot is just they think of the fortune teller with the crystal ball or whatever, you know?
Right, right, right.
And I was like, no, it's actually like, you know, this is something in like Jungian psychology that's totally like considered and acknowledged, as they'll approach that as a series of archetypes, you know. And I was giving an argument for that. And it was funny and I was like, it's kind of strange. And like her dad was like, that is strange. He's like, it's a strange thing for me to say at the table or something, you know.
Right, right, right.
Like looking for deeper meaning in Groundhog Day. But when I said it afterwards, I started thinking about it. And I was like, wow, there's actually, I don't remember how much you went into on that post that you did there. I read it, but something struck me was the idea of the shadow. And because I had mentioned it in terms of Jung, I was considering so the shadow is huge. And so you have, what is it, lacuna, the emptiness, you know, which they used in Eternal Sunshine for the name of the company that erased your memory or whatever. But it's this big thing in psychology where you have that, you know, Eros is born of chaos, right? So you have like the counterpart, the masculine counterpart to Psyche, which is where the Roman Cupid came from, which was related to which was opposite Venus, right? Is used in psychology. There's this notion of the masculine and the feminine opposites, which is common. But basically, I was considering this whole thing about that chaos being the shadow, and then considering that when you lay the cards out as the hero's journey, where you create kind of this ellipse, right? Which is really interesting when you look at the way that Crowley rearranged the cards in the way that he did in a couple places to see how that ellipse forms, like because it changes the end cards. I believe lust is at one end then, because there's two cards on both sides that are separate from the ellipse in a way, you know?
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
So, and then considering that you have the hero's journey, you have the solar level, and then you have the underworld level, so that's where they tie in. That's why it's Thoth Tarot, is because the Egyptians have this idea of the sun, and then the sun is, you have, what is it, Apep, the serpent that tries to stop the sun along its underworld journey. And then Osiris is arisen at the midnight, or however you want to say it, in the middle of the night, basically.
Yeah.
And then basically resurrected as the sun of the new day, you know. And then the sky boat and all of that stuff. But I was considering like what that means in terms of Groundhog Day when you consider the his female counterpart, who he's, you know, trying to you know, coax into sleeping with him. If you look at her as his shadow, and how you know, you could basically take it that, you know, the groundhog needs to see his shadow. He's Phil. The groundhog's name is Phil. So there's obviously, yeah, they're expressing that he is looking to see his own shadow. And it's like she, he has all these representations about her that have nothing to do with her. So in the same way you have like Psyche, Eros has to get to know Psyche, and their unification is, you know, basically that you're only able to move forward in any real way after that. Otherwise, all you have is this repeated neurosis cycle or whatever. So I was just considering, like, it's the end of his neurosis at the end of Groundhog Day when he finally sees his shadow, which is the female. But I was looking at it in terms of your posts and trying to kind of contemplate that.
It seems to me, so if she's sort of like the anima figure, right? So it's like she could be a dark figure or a light figure depending on sort of his own personal development,
right? She's the high priestess and he is the fool.
Exactly. And if the very first time you see her, she's standing in front of a blue screen, right? She's like it's like a stage for like for weathermen. So it's a TV studio. So you see a blue screen and there's two gray columns on either side of the blue screen. So you see her with a blue jacket on, standing on a blue background with two pillars on either side of her. So it seems very clear to me that she's shown as the high priestess, which is both, can be the dark figure or the light figure.
Right. If she's a source of pain for him, she's a dark figure. If she's a source of joy for him, then yeah, she's a bright figure.
True of every relationship I think any human being has ever had.
Right. So this extends to What About Bob really well, because what About Bob is, you know, this Freudian psychologist. You know, you can see he names his son Sigmund. You know, it's like he's got the statue there. He's like, anyways, you know, he's not wanting to see his own shadow, which is Bob, right? So Bob is his own, like, basically his demon, so to speak.
Do you remember the movie poster for What About Bob?
It's a giant shadow of him.
Yeah.
At him, and he's shaking his hand or something. I can't.
Yeah. Remember. Yeah, that's basically it. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so there you go. It's like, and it's his shadow coming out and being like, fuck you to all he's repressed, which is the other side of himself. And there was an article that was written on that. I think I showed it to you. I don't know if you read that, but at one point somebody had done a whole like step-by-step analysis of What About Bob, backing up that thesis that they're actually the same person, subtextually.
I actually have not seen that. Yeah, I don't, if you showed that to me, I don't recall that at all. That's it's funny. I actually almost watched that movie. I don't watch a lot of movies, but that popped into my head about 2 months ago that I was thinking I should try and find that movie. I hadn't seen it since it came out in theaters. You know, it was probably like 12 years old or something. It was definitely on my mind, and I definitely see what you're saying here about this sort of correlation. There's this one thing that kind of stands out to me about that movie, and again, I haven't seen it in years, but I know there was this whole thing where he had this, like, fear of the water. So this whole thing where, like, they go out on a boat and they have to, like the guy has, like, a yacht or something, and they finally, like, get him out onto the boat. And there's, like, this scene, you know, this sort of these series of scenes where they're trying to get him into the water or get him onto the boat or something. You know, when you said that he names his kid Sigmund, the first thing that popped in my head was Sigmund and the Sea Monster.
Uh-huh.
Right? So you have, like, the Leviathan, or this sort of dark creature of the abyss, being very much another play on this exact same imagery.
Well, I wanted to look up the epic. I know that Jung, like how Freud identified a lot with in his work, with he had the Oedipus complex, right? That was like one of his big
yeah,
contributions, but he was really, like,
shall we say fixated.
Fixated on the Oedipal complex. And then, you know, Jung was fixated actually on a story that had to do with the sea. And it's like a hero.
The Night Sea Journey, yeah.
Night Sea Journey. And I thought that I had considered that. In the film, there's this whole thing where Sigmund doesn't want to dive. He's afraid of diving. And so Bob is actually the one that finally gets him to dive. And there's a part where...
Oh, that's what it... Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Doctor actually comes out and pushes Bob into the water because he's so excited that his son is, you know, finally able to dive. But if you look at them as they're the same person, it's like he doesn't want his repressed side to take credit or be responsible for any form of success. So because he's like he's got the analytical, like very, you know, rigid side of him, which doesn't want the free unrepressed libido to take over and have anything to do with his children or his sister, actually. So, like, Bob ends up marrying his sister, which is the most devastating thing imaginable. And so if you look at it from, like the era of Psyche, you know, they look at that as brother and sisterhood. That is actually, like, even though it's, like, they're romantic, it's also taken to be brother and sisterly love, which is, you know, interesting, which is why they say, like, you know, psychologically, the way that we relate to these things and why we don't, like, what it is that maintains a lot of these insights from occurring, like how we could be so unconscious of an Oedipal complex is because we're like, you know, we don't want to relate and consider our mothers in that way. And so that remains repressed, you know. So same thing is with his sister, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's like there's something that sort of haunts me to this day is, you know, sort of both angles. I have a sort of personal thing here is my mom, my mom got breast cancer a number of years ago. And then, you know, there was this sort of process with that. And at some point, my mom got upset because she felt like I wasn't asking her enough about it. I wasn't, you know, being supportive or like asking for more information to be a part of the process, which I have, in some extent, I have my personal reasons for that is because I disagree with the procedure she was getting. And that was a conversation I wasn't able to have. Whereas I don't think chemotherapy is the appropriate, could say, cure in 99% of the cases. But that was a conversation, you know, you can't have with someone who's already thinks you're just crazy skeptic, and they're going through an emotional period and they're going to take the best advice they can get. So I sort of detached myself from that and just tried to be emotionally supportive without being really talking about it. It's just it's an unfortunate dynamic there, you know?
Yeah.
And, so she made this, so there was this thing. And then that same day I made, I guess, this sort of Freudian slip later in the day, someone said something, I don't remember what it was, and someone said something like, I really don't remember what the exact phrase was, but I'm with my family, and someone, like, maybe, like, my mom had, like, spilled something on her shirt or something, and or whatever it was, and I didn't notice it or whatever, and then someone said, like, and she was like, you didn't notice that? I was like, well, I try not to think about my mother's breasts, and she was like, yeah, I know, like, bringing it back to the earlier conversation of that I didn't want to talk about her breast cancer. But it was just a really interesting sort of personal interplay there, you know? So it's like what you're... you see the way these things kind of seep in. So there is a basis for this stuff. I don't think that means I have an Oedipal complex, you know, directly, like I want to fuck my mother. But there is certainly that strangeness for, well, I see it as this quasi-scientific thing that upset me, that kind of distanced me from it. I have to give some credit to the fact that that's probably, for a young boy, probably not a pleasant conversation to think about his mother's breasts to begin with.
Right, right. It seems like just like, you know, a big part of what that seems to be about, like, everybody wants to return to the womb and become a blind cave fish again. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, who you are. There's that, like,
I like that you said blind cave fish, because doesn't Oedipus end up tearing his eyes out?
Yeah. No, that's, yeah, totally. where you're just basically completely absorbed in,
yeah,
that's like unity, right? And there's just being consciousness, right? And so on that level, what is that but wanting to return to the mother, which is an inevitability. And a lot of what the Oedipal story is about fate, and that nothing can save you from your own fate. And so no matter how he strategizes, this is what's happening. He's the one who kills his father, and he's the one who fucks his mother. And so there's just no way around that. And so there's no way around the fact that we all die. And so when there's no way around that we become our own people, and that to kill your father is also to basically be your own expression. And people want to follow, to be their old man. You know, you want to, like, you know, if you're a male, usually you know even if you hate your father on some level, you know, you still are driven to be a representative of a continuation of him, you know.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely.
And so to kill your father is to basically pave your own path, right? Which is to some degree an inevitability. It is your fate. And then it's also your fate to return back to the mother, which is the great mother, you know, and you can avoid it all you want to, but this is what's happening. And so I think a lot of, like, what people's reconciliation on the deathbed, it's like they become as children again. If things are truly reconciled, they see things through fresh eyes. They see things from a new perception, if they're actually having if death is a liberating experience on any level, you know. And that is basically a return, and you're returning. And so it's just that idea of the inevitability, but how, when those facts are repressed, the way they express themselves in one's life in terms of neurosis is what's being spoken of by, at least that's how I interpret Freud. This is a thing I actually wrote in my chapter, that I was like, one thing most psychoanalysts can agree on, and then I'm reading it after the fact, I'm like, what the fuck do psychoanalysts actually agree on?
Right.
But at the same time, at least I should have qualified that by saying Jungian psychologists, though they might phrase this in different language or consider it from different angles, this is like a oversimplification, which is what I did, which is what I had.
Which is what you have pages. To do. Yeah.
You have to agree with the nature of what it is that I'm doing. But at the same time, like, you know, there are commonalities. And even though, like, that's how I interpret Freud, no, and if, like, I'm no expert on Freud, I have friends that are, who went through that whole process, you know, and they would, if I say some of my ideas, they'll just pull it apart for days, which is what you're supposed to do there, you know. That's why, you know, it takes so long to be certified as such, you know. I mean, Amy's a psychologist, you know. She wanted to be a psychoanalyst, she'd have to go through a lot more schooling, you know. And then if you want to be a Jungian psychologist, you go through a hell of a lot too, you know. Like, that's a pretty intensive thing to get involved in. So, you know, I could call myself a pseudo you know, dabbler in psychology, you know. It's like,
oh yeah, I mean, yeah. And then that's okay, because I think if what we're doing, and not to make it so grand or anything, but I do think is probably on a sense, truer to the actual material. So, you know, Jung saw this as, hey, here's something where this could be used therapeutically. If we can show people sort of what's inside them and kind of make them bring it to their to a conscious level, hey, this would be really helpful. And, you know, to an extent, Freud, the same sort of thing with the repressed side. I think what we're doing is doing this on a sort of macro scale, you know, where they're doing it for a specific patient, where it seems like we alternate between doing it on this macro scale where we're seeing this sort of some sort of cosmic consciousness, and at the same time probably spending all this time kind of psychoanalyzing ourselves, you know, as above, so below. So where we sometimes focus on the macro and realize that we're very much also focused on the personal, which I don't think is a bad thing. I think if you can understand this stuff, I guess that's what I was trying to say. It's like, not that we, I don't know, I'm hesitant to make what we do so sound so grand, but I think this is taking it outside of the level of the personal therapist relationship and taking it to a point where teaching someone how to fish, you know?
Right. I think there's something to be said from like removing it from the couch, you know,
yeah.
Like, which is what happened anyway. I mean, that's just where it gets focalized and people have a more direct means to actually work things out. And you simultaneously want to avoid keeping all these things too conceptual in order to actually consider real possibilities for change in one's life. Like, if you keep things on a certain, that's the thing about analyzing, like, and that's why you have to, the one who's doing the analyzing has to be willing to analyze himself, you know, more than just breaking himself into fragments, but rather how those fragments actually connect, because it's in the unification of the dualities that healing occurs, which is the role of Eros and Psyche, right? It's like, it's always in the unification of things that any reconciliation occurs, and you know, until things are laid out on the table, it's kind of difficult to actually see how it's connected. You know, it's like that's a big issue. It's like, well, if we're like for whatever reason, if you're not allowed or able to, have things like, how does this relate to this? Like, generally, if things are worlds enough apart, people don't ever consider that. And so that's like one of the valuable things about sync, is that you can be like, okay, well, there's these two things. What the hell do they have to do with each other? You know, like, I find like the act of like, whenever I look at a mythology now, even if it's something that I haven't seen written about or spoken about, in psychological terms, it's just a myth. It's a story. You know, I like at this point, because of what I've looked at, I can't help but see, well, how are some different ways that this could relate to my psyche, like, and to my being across the board? Like, I always look at every myth that I look at now from a metaphorical perspective. You know, I can't help it, which I think is like, you know, pretty valuable, because there's definitely some creativity that plays into that. And even if it is that you're just projecting, it doesn't mean that this is what was intended about this myth, but this is what this means for you, then it becomes something you can work with.
Yeah, I think this, you know, this is something I think a lot of us do, is we get to this sort of looking at all as metaphor, and you can see how it applies personally or, again, to the macrocosm. I think just like with all this stuff, I don't think I have to tell you this, but just I feel it's an important little disclaimer to put on it, is I think it's important to balance that out, because I've also encountered some people in sync where everything becomes metaphor and you forget that there's a sort of, and you know, we could question the term real world, but there is a real world correspondence that goes beyond the metaphor. So, you know, your girlfriend might be a metaphor for some sort of inner anima figure or, she could be your shadow, she could be any of these things, but on another hand, you know, she could be your goddess, your whatever. But on another hand, she's also a real human being that has real needs that you should communicate with on a human level. Of course, we should always attain to have communication on some sort of psycho-spiritual level between people we're in love with. But on a also practical ground-based level, this is someone who needs to be, you know, ask how was your day? Or, you know, just the, like these simple things where we sometimes get so stuck in our heads of, it's metaphor, it's metaphor, it's metaphor, and then it's to say, but I sometimes feel that people need to be pulled back a little in the other direction and say, hey, remember, it's not just metaphor. It's both. Yes, this is a metaphor for an internal dialogue. This is a metaphor for an internal process on a personal level. And yet that's also a real life human being, individual with whom you can have a very meaningful relationship in a practical way. And the ideal, I think, would be to do both.
Right. Yeah, it's Dan in real life. It's like, okay, his head is on a stack of pancakes. You know, if you flip the D, it is a P. Okay, he's Pan, but he's also Dan in real life.
Yes. So I think I'm going to have to watch What About Bob? It's, you know, so I just want to take this, if we can, Groundhog Day, I'm more familiar with, is there's the first woman he sees every morning upon waking. We want to take this to this sort of Oedipus story.
Yeah, who he gets the poster from when he, or no, it's like, he drops the poster in the bathtub, right, and kills himself. And
yeah, exactly, yeah.
Like, so like, what are you doing, or whatever, I don't know, I haven't in a minute, but yeah
basically he comes downstairs and there's this like old lady who's kind of like the, I don't know, like innkeeper or whatever you would call that, like the woman who runs the bed and breakfast. I don't know what you would call that, but there's this woman that he sees every morning, and what I notice is that she stands in front of a mirror. So of course we have his love interest is standing in front of a blue screen, which of course you can use to project anything you want upon. Now, the older woman is standing in front of a mirror, which again, you can project onto this mirror, and it will reflect back to you whatever you cast onto it. So I think it's very appropriate. She's standing in front of a mirror with two pillars on either side, and there's this small lamp next to her, which looks very much like a moon. So what I see this is, in this sense, she's almost a more literal depiction of the Rider-Waite High Priestess, because she even has this little moon globe there. But ultimately, the way I saw it is that she's sort of playing double duty. It's that sort of the same way we might have the triple-faced goddess or something like that, where she is another aspect of the High Priestess, certainly. But I ended up placing her as the Empress for reasons I explained in the post. But it's very interesting to me to see her as another aspect of the, what is this woman's name? Like McDowell?
Yeah, a name that sounds like a...
Andy? Like Andy McDowell?
Actually, like that, yeah.
I can't think of the character's name, but basically, so this idea that, like, this is the woman he sees upon waking every day, which we can kind of see as related to if you were sleeping with a woman, you know, who's the first woman you see every morning. And then I believe at some point he ends up kissing the woman. Like, there's, like, one day where he's all happy and he, like, grabs her and kisses her or something. But, it's always funny to me to kind of think about, we don't know how long he's actually there, how many days he lives over and over and over again. But there comes a point where he starts to treat her very differently, this older woman, where he starts to like, whatever. But you notice the only time he does that is after he starts to sleep with all the women in town. So there's always, I have this sort of wondering, does he sleep with the old woman one day just for the hell of it? And that's... suddenly he can't stand her anymore. Because that's what he does to the younger women.
Huh, that's interesting. You know, Andy McDowell had a small part in St. Elmo's Fire.
Okay.
He's also Lord of the Apes, which is interesting. But I was just considering St. Elmo's Fire because it reminds me of St. Anthony's Fire. You know, I believe that was in my chapter I talk about. St. Anthony's Fire is the term used for ergot poisoning when it happens on a mass scale. So if a bunch of people receive ergot poisoning or whatever, I mean, or the phenomenon of ergot poisoning, I guess, across the board is just called St. Anthony's Fire because St. Anthony is a patron saint of ergot poisoning.
But if I'm not mistaken, isn't St. Elmo's Fire a phenomenon that's reported on night sea journeys?
Is that, I'm curious. I want to know what that came from because that kept on coming up. I was like,
Yeah, I believe it's like a sailing term. St. Elmo's Fire is a weather phenomenon. Let's see. St. Elmo's Fire is a weather phenomenon in which luminous plasma is created by a coronal discharge from a sharp or pointed object in a strong electric field in the atmosphere, such as those generated by thunderstorms or created by volcanic eruption. St. Elmo's Fire is named after St. Erasmus of Formi, the patron saint of sailors. The phenomenon sometimes appeared on ships at sea during thunderstorms and was regarded by sailors with religious awe for its glowing ball of light, accounting for the name. Cool. Basically, so we have the night sea journey with this luminous apparition from God showing you the light in the middle of your dark sea journey, right?
Totally, yeah. So when you have, like, the dark night of the soul is also related to the sea journey. I was just looking at James Hillman talking about that, who is one of Jung's students. So, and the dark night of the soul, it's always darkest before the dawn, right? It's like, fire is like a, wow, that's interesting. Volcanic thunderstorms are created by a volcanic eruption. So if you were out at sea and you saw a volcano off in the distance exploding, that would be an example of that, or what? That's interesting. They're saying basically light in the darkness is what it means then, because if you say
yeah,
that's kind of far out.
There's another phrase for the night sea journey, which is like naushka, or there's another way of saying it. N A U S I C. Oh my God, I didn't even think of this. Sorry. That's Naushka is the character from a Miyazaki film. Nakuya. Let's see. Okay, Nakuya. This gets compared. So he spells it Nekyia. Or actually, I guess he probably didn't. Right, he probably wasn't writing in English. So, but in his translation, it's coming up as Nekyia. It's basically this sort of journey into the underworld, the same type thing, or contact with the underworld. So there's a thing. It's a phrase used to also for a chapter, a specific part of the Odyssey, the Homeric epic, the Odyssey, where Odysseus goes into the underworld. They call that this. I'm gonna keep saying the character from the Miyazaki film. I have this somehow connected in my mind. I'm gonna have to see what's up with that. But this is, they also call it catabasis or descent.
They say here it's a rite. So it's in necromancy. It's you're calling up ghosts and questioning them about the future.
Sure, there is that, but I there is this connection between your, so you can call them up or you can go down. I mean, all right, let's do this. I've had this conversation with Alexis, who you met at the cabin, and we've been talking about the hero's journey is, of course, coming from a very masculine hero, more often than not, right? It's the hero, he has to, like, go out, find his way in the world. He might become king, he might fall from his kingdom and become the fool again, or whatever it might be. He has to go...
Odysseus or...
Right. DC. But yeah, we've talked about how all the feminine heroes essentially do the journey in the opposite sequence. So you'll see, like, you know, take your classic ones, like in Alice in Wonderland or Labyrinth or any of these things, where the woman starts out in the real world and then she goes into a world that is a bizarre sort of abstract place, and then she finds her way sort of back to appreciating what she had in the quote-unquote real world. Do you understand what I mean?
Sure.
So whereas the man is going out to sort of identify himself and almost... It's similar. It's of course very similar. You're going out on the journey and sort of finding out who you are. But it seems that the feminine journey, it's just a difference of like what your sort of start sequence is. So he might be starting from the more egoic place, or he might be finding his ego along the way, where she might be coming from this more feminine id, intuition, and then exploring this other side. And mm-hmm. So if you could imagine, let's say, like, the hero's journey being a clockwise motion, the feminine journey is almost a counterclockwise motion, perhaps making like a... either on the same circle or perhaps like some sort of vesicle Pisces. We've had a lot of conversations here about this. So I guess the reason I want to bring that up, that might spark something in your mind, but there's also the idea that if this is, we can connect this to calling up the ghost, or you descend into hell, or you descend into the belly of the beast. So it's like you can call them up or you can go down, but it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, totally. I can't help but like consider what's going on right now and what's been going on around like 2012 predictions. Like I had my girlfriend's sister telling them about this National Geographic program she watched about 2012, and it just sounded like it was like leaving out like huge key things, like we were just talking about, that like they just, all they leave it at is this is the end of the calendar and here's what it might mean, and they're showing pictures of fucking like volcanoes and terrible cataclysm shit happening. They're like, they said that the Mayans all disappeared probably because of some cataclysm, which there's absolutely no evidence for, but here we have a National Geographic program telling you that that's likely, even though there's nothing there, you know. So most likely they migrated, and there's evidence for that apparently. But anyways, I find it interesting that it's a rite by which ghosts were called up in question about the future. And when you say that doing that action is necromancy, it's interesting the way that, people are attempting to like the desire to want to know about the future and then what they're calling on in order to be able to do that. Like people are relating to Quetzalcoatl, which is the ideal, like as above, so below figure because of the feathers and the serpent wings. But I mean, like Apep is the underworld serpent that follows the sun through the underworld and tries to stop it along its journey, you know, in Egyptian mythology. But there's this reoccurrence of like, you know, the like Dante's and Inferno, and obviously like like the story of Hercules with Cerberus and all of that, but it's like to what are people energetically doing on a certain level, in a way, by indulging in like end of the world prophecy type thinking? What is the implication there other than necromancy? Though most people who participate in that kind of indulgence wouldn't necessarily like call it that themselves, or see it that way, but in a sense, that's kind of what they're doing. I mean, even like a corporation itself is like a demonic entity in the sense that it is supernatural. It is not an entity that's anywhere in nature. It's only in the mind, and as such, it is a supernatural entity, right? And so I think people, when relating to this kind of thing, you know, are kind of making up. They're filling in the blanks themselves, and in doing so, they call upon different energetics in order to project those, or giving something substance through the power of the imagination. You know, if you're in, and so, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's interesting. Like, this is all about prophecy, what we're talking about here, and the idea of taking that from the underworld as Hades or Persephone or Hecate or whatever. You know, you're I don't know. It seems like the way people are relating to Quetzalcoatl, it's like he might as well be that object for them that's, you know, calling up the prophecy.
Interesting. You know, I mean, I've told you about the experience I had with Hecate, where for the only way I can sort of explain it is, like, she came to me in a dream. I don't even know where to begin with trying to explain the experience, but I definitely see your point is well taken. I think for me it's like trying to find this. Again, it's this idea of where does metaphor end and where does reality start, right? So are we actually calling up these entities, or are we trying to understand the archetype? And at what point do we make that distinction?
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, Crowley made points about, like, you know, being possessed by this spirit so that he could be in contact with another spirit. Or, you know, are there spirits? Are these archetypes? Are there some things that are archetypes and some things that are spirits? Are the archetypes so powerful and so basic that they might as well be spirits? I mean, these are, I think, excellent questions that I don't think we can even begin to, you know, what we could kind of do is stab at answers in the dark here. And I think because it sort of depends on, again, it depends on what you bring to it. So for someone who really believes that it's an entity, it might very well be. I'm just open to the idea that, how shall I say this? It's hard for me to be open to it because I consider myself somewhat agnostic about it all. You know, as far as, like, are these actual spirits, let's say. And yet I have, of course, have to remain open to the possibility. The same thing I said before, like, hey, you know, your wife or your girlfriend, your brother, your sister-in-law could all be archetypes, but you better also remember that they're real people and you should treat them well, you know, or respect them as such. Sometimes I wonder, okay, you know, we're talking about all these things as archetypes, and every now and then I have an experience where it feels like the archetype's going like, hey, asshole, I'm not just an archetype.
Right. Well, this is an idea in Kabbalah in relationship to the nechesh, or the soul, is that it's something that's actually built up. You build a soul. And this is something you'll see in psychoanalysis as well. Well, they'll speak of the soul as something that inseminate with life. You imagine. It's through the power of the imagination and the inseminating of it with your attention and energy that gives it substance. And so it seems as though that's also the same way spirits had been related to in a lot of different places. Like, I know I think I pronounced this wrong, but the Gotia, the Crowley, I think Mather's book of the different entities that you can, communicate to or call into existence.
Yeah.
But it's like, that's in, I mean, that's in the mind. Like, that's, they are intelligences, but they're also mind made. They've been given their existence through the power of the will, basically, and the ability of the mind to project. And so, like, you know, I just see, like, corporations are seem to be just that. States seem to be just that. Like, we make a flag, which is like a sigil, and then we imbue that with. We keep repeating the thing over and over again in order to make it so. Like, we salute it. We, we do ritual around it. And in those rituals, we give it substance. I just wanted to say really quick, looking at, how do you pronounce this? Nekia? Nekia?
So, I've been pronouncing it Nekuya. But there's a, but no, I mean, don't, please, I probably mispronounce everything, so, don't take my word for it. But see, basically, I had found an earlier, like, if you look at, say, Wikipedia, for example, there's one, they give you one spelling, N-E-K-Y-I-A. Okay, so it's saying, and here it's saying, an Nekuya is not necessarily the same thing as a katabasis. While they both afford the opportunity to converse with the dead, only a katabasis is the actual physical journey to the underworld. Okay, interesting. So it's saying, yeah, so three Platonic myths were classified as Nekuya, an underworld story in Homer's Odyssey. So whatever, I'm just saying, don't take my pronunciation for it. If anyone listening to this ever hears me pronounce something, verify that, because I have a bad habit of slaughtering words.
There's one of the best books I've ever read is by James Hillman, and it's The Dream in the Underworld, and I believe he went into it there, and I can see here under the Jung section, they're talking about, they have a quote from James Hillman about it. Where he says, the descent of the underworld can be distinguished from the night sea journey of the hero in many ways. The hero returns from the night sea journey in better shape for the task of life, whereas the Nekia takes the soul into the depth of his own, for its own sake, so that there is no return. The night sea journey is further marked by building interior heat, tapas, whereas the Nekia goes below that pressured containment, that tempering in the fires of passion to a zone of utter coldness. The devil image still haunts in our fears of the unconscious and the latent psychosis that supposedly lurks there, and we still turn to methods of Christianism, moralizing, kind feelings, communal sharing, and childlike naivety as propitiations against our fear. Instead of classical descent into the Nekia into imagination. Only after his Nekia, Freud, like, I don't know how you say this either, I guess it would have to be Aeneas, who carried his father on his back, could finally enter Rome. I need to catch up on my mythology, but I find that this, the distinction in that way of the night sea journey to what we're speaking of here, that things aren't necessarily, like, reconciled, per se, or in better shape. Though, some lines from Jim Morrison's poem, The Lords, come to mind when thinking about this and relating. I was like, where did I see this idea related to sleep? And so I have the book right here, so I grabbed it. So this, and this I said earlier about being a blind cavefish, and, like, we all want to be blind cavefish, because there's this line, in the womb we are blind cavefish. Everything is vague and dizzy, the skin swells, and there is no more distinction between parts of the body. An encroaching sound of threatening, mocking, monotonous voices. This is fear of attraction, of being swallowed. Inside the dream, button sleep around your body like a glove, free now of space and time. free to dissolve in the streaming summer. Sleep is an under ocean dipped into each night, at morning awake, dripping, gasping, eyes stinging. But this is like in James Hillman's The Dream in the Underworld, he relates going to sleep every night as a descent into the underworld.
Absolutely.
And that's why. And so like the substratum of symbolism and what gets communicated is like everything that's generally been repressed, you know, the mind has free range during the night and will communicate things in abstract ways. And it is this wonderland or this like, you know, Oz realm where everything is communicating through like archetypal symbolism, a deeper meaning that we're perfectly aware of in the dream on certain levels and on other levels completely ignorant or oblivious to, that we might get years later or we might never get. And so I don't know, I find nation interesting considering like wanting to return to the womb, which is the Oedipal you know, inclination, which we all have. You know, you'd call, I guess you'd call it the complex. You'd say you want to kill your mother and fuck your father. It's still on a certain level essentially the same. But I don't know. I think it's interesting. That's like definitely a sync between, you know, the underworld, the dream, and the desire to return to source.
Oh, it's, yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, I think that's basically sort of what's fixated me over the last few years is that very same idea. I mean, in the Leary, Alpert, Metzner psychedelic experience, they make this very explicit with it. You know, they're comparing it, the psychedelic experience to the Tibetan Book of the Dead. They're saying the exact same thing. They're saying, every night you die, every night that you go to sleep, you die. This act of sleep is a small death. That we have a series of small deaths throughout our life, and these are all sort of practice for death. Now there's that twist on it, but this James Hillman quote is important, I think, because that's kind of what I was trying to say. And you know, it's particularly in the last few months that I've become a lot more, in a sense, conservative about how I think there, I feel a sort of obligation since I've been the promoter of a lot of this stuff, you know, going out and promoting the Sync book and different people's research. I think I've this sort of obligation to be a little more cautious and conservative in what I say has crept up on me, and I'm actually kind of happy for it in the sense that I think there's a say like some of like the you know, like the language that gets thrown around where it's you know, ego death. I believe ego death is a really important thing. Doesn't mean we just want to go out and kill ourselves. Right? When you say kill yourself, you're trying to kill your ego identity, but we don't want to encourage people to go out and kill themselves, like actually commit suicide. When you talk, you know, that sort of sinkhole concept of sink, don't swim, these sort of things where, I'm sorry, it's James, Jim Sanders, you know, has a video, which is an excellent video, called The King of Love is a Dead Man. Excellent, excellent video. And it really touches on a lot of this stuff. The idea that, you know, you have to die in yourself to give to this, to experience this sort of back to the womb, great mother connection. But I think what's important, I've found it's very important to stress, is that make some of these distinctions and to say this idea that whereas this James Hillman quote says the night sea journey, you hope to make it through stronger on the other side, which I don't agree with this as saying night sea journey means you're stronger and the descent into the underworld is not a return. I don't think we can make that clear distinction, but to say that sometimes you don't make it through. You might make it through your night sea journey. You might be on a ship that's in a storm, and you might survive, but you might be on a plank of wood starving to death, you know, floating across the ocean, and you might make it. You might fucking make it. But, you know, you're not necessarily like, oh, stronger now, your ship is destroyed.
This brings up a huge point. Like, this is super important, what's being said right here. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Did you?
No, you get what I'm saying. It's like, there is a way, you know, there's a way to get lost in this process. I watched a documentary with my wife. My wife's a dancer. I watched a documentary with her recently about ballet. I mean, I've seen many ballet documentaries over the years, but this one in particular, they gave a special 10 minutes of attention to what I hear every dancer complaining about is injuries and how common it is for dancers to have injuries. And they were saying that ballerinas get more physical injuries than, you know, football players or any professional athlete. They're doing so much intensive work on their bodies, and their bodies are certainly more frail. But it was this idea of that the injury sort of came with the territory. And what I feel like I've suddenly wanted to stress, not for any other reason, but because I think we can be overly flamboyant about, like, yeah, go gobble some psychedelics, go have some fun, and, you know, no, I don't think anyone's actually saying that, but I think sometimes it has the danger of coming across that way. And it's this idea that you can have psychic injury. What we're doing is we're doing a very intricate dance, a tightrope walk over fucking madness, trying to find something true in that swirling maelstrom of madness. And you could just as easily get lost in the maelstrom.
Well, that's it, right? So here we're making a distinction where you have these descents into the underworld, or, you know, the abyss, or the primordial waters, and how just to make that journey doesn't necessitate where you'll come out on the other side. And why is it that some people will have very religious or initiatory, either psychedelic or otherwise, experiences, and actually hold more, become more attached to certain mental idols than before they entered? And I think it's because if you're looking at what the imagination can be projecting in the midst of that, without like a degree of perspective, you can take everything at face value and continue on through the whole experience doing that and come out the other side with no like further depth other than in strictly the imagination, which has its own value, but at the same time isn't always necessarily ultimately liberating.
Yeah, well, sure, like, you could make it through the storm. Like, let's take, like, a literal storm story. Say someone's on a storm at night, and then they, you know, they get ravaged in this storm, and their boat gets turned over and all this sort of stuff, and then someone might say, it was my faith that kept me going. I knew that God would provide for me, and all this sort of stuff. So you've, like you said, you know, you can reinforce your belief system in that sense, which, you know, I'm not trying to shit on anyone's belief system. I just mean that your point is very well taken, that I think there are times where someone could go through a rough period and it could actually cement their ideas rather than force them to face the abyss that is this projective screen, the blue screen that Andy McDowell stands in front of, you know?
Yeah, I had a repeated thing during an experience where I could see the degree to which my mind would, if I would just tip it in a certain direction in terms of projecting like an image or a series of images, it would just take off and I would just get these huge, like, manifestations emerge, but I could maintain an awareness of, I initiated that. I put that in place through the power of my projection and my belief. And so things would get super elaborate, and it would just be these textural, like, unbelievably massive things, but I'm like, wow, no, where, like, the seed was planted by myself. Like, this may appear at this point as an outside intelligence, but it's still an aspect of me. And I think it's very challenging for people taking that kind of journey to basically keep that perspective, because it's so easy to just think that this is all. If you want to believe it, you can. Anything you want to believe, you will perceive to a degree, you know. And so if you want this to be coming from outside, that this is actually Jesus coming from, you know, outside and talking to you, you can go with that, and that'll work for you, you know. I don't know. I guess I'm just making the same point again in different terms, but I could just, you know, recognize the degree of my own part, which I think is sometimes hard to do because it's so tempting to want to take it on another level, because things can get very grandiose very, very, very fast in the midst of a certain state.
Hell yeah. You know, I mean, isn't this, I think to an extent, this is, there's a sort of this story of, right, like the Moses saying he performed these feats. Now, in a sense, see, this is where we get into these, like, tricky territories, right? So if you say, well, it's all a projection of you, you can lead someone into this sort of solipsism where it's all me.
Right, which is like nihilism, or can be, you know?
Yeah, I don't think it's all that different. Yeah, because to be a solipsist means you're basically denying everyone else's existence. Nothing exists but me. You know, so I think that's definitely a form of nihilism.
Oh, Vincent Eastwood is saying, yo, I'm here.
Oh, cool. So you know what? Let's take a... let me stop recording for a second.
Drive!